Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, I'm Francis Lamb, and this is Splendid Table Selects, our mini podcast about the stuff that makes us better cooks and eaters. In French kitchens, the most respected cook is the saucier, the person who makes the sauces. You can't have tacos without salsa, and Beyoncé keeps hot sauce in her bag, so obviously sauces are key to food. But what is a sauce, technically, and how do we start making them? Marianne Tebben is a head of the food studies department at Bard College at Simon's Rock, and she wrote a book called Sauces, A Global History. Our friend Noelle Carter found out all about them. Have a listen.
Marianne, I'm so excited to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What would you say constitutes a sauce? How would you define it?
So it's really difficult to define a sauce, I've found. I like to say that sauces are not food, but they're of food, because the basic elements are that it's a refined preparation that's a complement or a contrast to food. So it's edible, but you don't eat it by itself. So you have to have what the industrial food industry likes to call a host food, and then the sauce acts as a complement or a contrast. And so I say refined preparations because you can have elemental ingredients that are food adjuncts that add flavor to food, but they're not sauces like salt. And so the problem is where to go from there. So in my book, I say mainly sauces are smooth liquid preparations, but that's not true of salsa, for example. It's not true of hard sauce for British desserts. And so then you have to kind of go from there and refine it. And the essential element is that it's something that adds flavor to food, but doesn't stand on its own. And there the debates begin. What's interesting to me about sauce in general as a subject of study is that there are lots of debates about sauce, inside of sauce, national identity, linguistic questions. So it's a huge subject, and that's why I was fascinated and why I wanted to write this book.
How far back do sauces go? When is the earliest documentation?
The origin sauces that I talk about this is about 5th century China, and they're condiments. And I should say that the origin of the word condiment means it's something that adds flavor to food. And so these original sauces are fermented meat condiments. And again, this is 5th century BC China. And those meat condiments are written about, and they're described as to food what a general is to an army. So they sort of lead and perfect and correct food. And those meat-based fermented sauce preparations turn into soy sauce eventually. So the meat is replaced by soy, and those are fermented sort of more paste than sauces. And then you get to soy sauce around the 3rd century AD. And soy sauce dominates China for a long, long time. And then it gets imported into Japan around the 12th century AD. And you see fermented sauces go from there. And then in more water-centric countries, you have fish sauces, which a lot of people know about. So Indonesia, Vietnam, you have these fish sauces. And garum, the Roman sauce, fermented fish sauce, is roughly around the same time. And so the fish sauce in Rome is relatively similar to the fish sauces in Vietnam and Indonesia. And those fermented sauces are the oldest sauces. But vinegar is a component of other sauces, and vinegar is roughly contemporary to those early meat-based fermented meat condiments. So those are the origin sauces, and they lead into all kinds of other sauces, including the ketchup that we know now, which started out as a fermented product, was fermented mushrooms or walnuts originally in the English version, and it becomes a tomato preparation much, much later.
One thing I found fascinating was, contrary to popular myth, sauces were not made to disguise bad or putrid food, but more as a condiment to complement the dish.
Right. So the origin of sauces are these fermented preparations. And I talk about sauces as contrastive or complementary. And the contrastive sauces are these preparations, sometimes they were spice mixes, that were meant to correct food. And so the idea, this is from Galen, and this is late antiquity. The idea is that foods on their own, meats, for example, have a certain humor, and they're either cold or hot. And it has nothing to do with the temperature of the cooked food, for example. It's the inherent quality of the food. So meat was thought to be cold, not all meats, but some meats were thought to be cold, and you wanted to counteract that with something hot, like pepper. So in order for the food to be nutritional, in order to be digested well, you'd counteract, contrast it with something like a sauce. And it wasn't to cover putrid meat, because meat was expensive, spices were expensive, and so the person who's eating meat and or spices has enough money to buy fresh meat. And it wasn't that. It was to make the food nutritionally sound. And that practice continues for a long time until about the 14th century, and there's someone called Magninus in Milan who writes a book talking about the contrastive quality of sauces, and he also says that sauces can be useful nutritionally because they make food taste better, and when food tastes better, you want to eat more of it, and that can be a nutritional benefit, as long as you don't eat too much. And that's when the idea of contrastive versus complementary starts to change. And you see in the 14th century, in the 15th century, in the Renaissance, these sauces that become less contrastive and more complementary. And the big change is butter. In 1651, there's a French chef, La Varenne, who is the first to introduce a butter-based roux for thickening sauces. And this changes French sauces forever. And so there was some departure from the contrastive sauce idea around that time, and butter wins the day.
Butter always seems to win the day, doesn't it?
It's true. I agree.
One of your last chapters explores odd sauces, dessert sauces, whipped cream, cranberry sauce in a can, and more. I'm curious, where do you think sauces are going, and how has molecular gastronomy changed the game?
I have thought about this, the future of sauce, and it's very hard to predict. Molecular gastronomy is very interesting because this gets back to the definition of sauce. So is it still a sauce if it's a foam or an ice or even a smoke or a scent? And those are all sauces, according to molecular gastronomy. And I think they are because they still complement food. They're a refined preparation. They add flavor. So that's changed the sauce world a lot, but it's really more on the high end. So it makes sauce much more interesting. But I'm not sure on a ground level that that's changed the sauce world too much. We have seen vinegar carry through. So vinegar-based sauces, ketchup is one of them. But there are lots of other examples. And the spicy sauces, Tabasco and Sriracha, are still quite popular. So I see those hanging on, carrying through. But I was thinking about this recently, what's the next step maybe? And it seems as though everything old is new again. And I was thinking about horseradish. So horseradish is an old ingredient, and horseradish sauce has been around a long time. But I think it's maybe poised for a return because it has, horseradish sauce has that vinegar base that people seem to align with, seem to like. It also has the heat that you can up or down depending on your taste. So it's sort of a daring sauce. There's a Swedish sauce for herring called pepperot sauce, and that sounds like something that I'd like to try. So it has the heat, and it's also herring and horseradish, so it's sort of daring. So I do wonder if horseradish is not the next step. I'm fascinated by celery sauce. I discovered celery sauce in Pittsburgh Heinz archives.
Huh.
And in the 19th century, it was popular because it was supposed to be healthy for brain and nerve. And it was a common condiment sauce in restaurants for a long time. And it disappeared right around the turn of the 20th century, and you don't see it anymore. But it was a commercial sauce produced by Heinz.
Maybe we'll see that making a comeback.
I wonder.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much. The book was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
That was Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director Noelle Carter with Professor Marianne Tebbin, author of Sauces, A Global History. Learn more about Marianne and her book on our website. And while you're there, be sure to check out the collection of sauce recipes we put together. It's all at splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening to this episode of Splendid Table Selects. You'll find us back in your podcast queue on Friday. And until then, I'm still Francis Lamb. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.